evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, March 26, 2019. One activist promoting peace in South Sudan says he wants to gain experience from the United States.
The young people in South Sudan, much as they're enthusiastic, skilled, and are faced with three main things. One of the issues is the question of unemployment. There's nothing happening for the young people. Our young people are not empowered.
And gender equality dominates a panel discussion during Women's History Month.
All my 30 years, I've lived under a patriarchal society. It is time that we actually create spaces for women to engage and know and realize their capacities.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A South Sudanese civil society activist is in the United States to learn more about how to prevent violence in South Sudan. Tongo James is participating in a regional program on empowering youth to strengthen communities and prevent violence, a project under the International Visitor Leadership Program. James says he is passionate about peace building in South Sudan and hopes to learn about America's experiences during its civil rights movement.
I'm here in Washington on a peace and exchange program that brings leaders from Africa, and I'm actually participating in the regional program, and it is called the International Visitors Leadership Program, and that's why I'm here.
When you're here in the United States, what would you like to take back home?
Back home, I work with the young people and also try my best to engage in peace-building-related processes and activities. And when we are doing this, I am here to understand how the Americans have done theirs over the years, considering that America is known for its long history of democracy and have been engaging in good governance and a lot more, combating violent extremisms. So we are here actually to learn the experiences of the people of America, the engagement of the government, trying to support the people, and especially the young people.
Talk to me about the young people in South Sudan. You said you work with young people in South Sudan. How is the environment there for young people to engage in activities of peace building?
Well, the level of our engagement in South Sudan, it's still minimal, I can say, considering the country being a new one. We have numerous challenges, but nevertheless, the young people have risen up. They are actually in the last 3 years, they are coming back into their space and trying their best to claim their opportunities and also try to engage. Much need to be done, and so this exchange, I hope, will be able to also refreshen our way of thinking and see how we can be able to develop our engagement with the young people further.
Talking about engagement with the young people, it's my understanding that the freedom of speech is very expensive in South Sudan.
Indeed, you may know that issues related to freedom of speech sometimes is really, you know, I can say it's in a working progress. It's really hard, but then nevertheless, our effort is to try and make sure that this space is granted. We would definitely continue to engage the local authority and try to see how they can be able to expand the space, and we continue to interact and try to build on that. But all in all, it's still a challenging experience. Yeah.
And talk to me a little bit about your work in South Sudan. I mean, what have you done?
Well, it's quite difficult to actually blow my own trumpet, but over the years, at a national level, I think I had a lot of engagements in forms of training young people, organizing platforms and forums where young people come and interact, share their experiences, and also try to engage in policy development-related activities. you probably know that the youth development policy had been in its stages of development since 2012, and we had been closely following up with this, and it's still ongoing. And then there are other related activities on skills development. We run a skills development training in especially computer training for young people, youth and women, and that's what my organization is doing for now.
What are some of the issues facing young people in South Sudan? You just talked about a menu of what your organization is doing, but what are the issues facing young people in South Sudan?
Well, I can summarize it in three main things. The young people in South Sudan, much as they're enthusiastic, skilled, and so forth, are faced with three main things. One of the issues is the question of unemployment. There's nothing happening for the young people. Our young people are not empowered. So when we're talking about empowerment, I'm talking about a national strategy or a national program that mainly focus on young people, the development of young people. We can talk about a development scheme and so forth. We are still trying to see how it will work, though, considering that we have it also in the revitalized peace agreement as one of the observations. So we wanted to see how that can unfold, but this is the ongoing challenges.
That's Tongo James, Executive Director of the Juba-based non-profit New Page for Peace and Development. He was speaking with me earlier today here in Washington. This is the last week of Women's History Month, and in keeping with this year's theme of visionary women, champions of peace and nonviolence, the U.S. Initiative of Peace hosted a group of women to talk about their progress towards achieving equal opportunities in their respective countries. Ayendeng Bior has details from Washington.
The USIP panel for Women's History Month concluded that women's leadership in nonviolent movements can create opportunities for new and diverse tactics that can lead to a diversity of participation, eventually increasing a movement's power. But panelist Scovia Arenatwe, a team leader at Rising Women Uganda, says in East Africa, it is often difficult for women to break through the system of patriarchy.
All my 30 years, I've lived under a patriarchal society. And for me, it is time that we actually create spaces for women to engage and know and realize their capacities as women. When we get there, we can then, according to me, we can then begin discussing how to bring men on board.
Some progress has been made toward the goal of achieving a more gender-equal world, according to the UN, but many countries have a lot of work to do. Women's representation in national parliament is at 23.7%. 750 million women and girls were married before the age of 18, and at least 200 million women and girls in 30 countries have undergone FGM, according to UN Women. Arenatwe says their issues are no different.
And the borders are really like just created, but we are the same people. So what affects this woman here will definitely affect me in this space. So for me, it's really to say we need to create that sisterhood and regional solidarity, but knowing that an injustice against one woman is an injustice against all women.
Equal access to education, political participation, access to health and economic freedom can fast-track countries toward a more sustainable future, according to Arenatwe. But she says leaders must change too.
I think if you look at the context right now in Africa and more so around East Africa, is that you will just realize that it's one leader learning from the other. So when you talk about Burundi and the repression in Burundi, you would want to talk about Sudan as well. And maybe you would want to talk about Zimbabwe. Maybe you want to talk about Rwanda right now. And so even when it is not visible in Rwanda, like if you read, you find out that it's more or less the same. It's just a tactic that is different. So the question around women organizing and, you know, expressing themselves in the different countries where dictatorships exist, it's the same.
Gender equality is number 5 in the UN's list of 17 sustainable development goals. UN Women says all 17 goals, including ending poverty and hunger, depend on the achievement of gender equality. Ayen Dangbior, VOA News, Washington.
A number of vice chancellors at South Sudan's public universities say they have run out of money. Addressing members of the Parliamentary Committee on Education today, some officials say they won't reopen the universities until the government approves an increase in tuition fees. Last week, President Salva Kiir cancelled a move by the Vice Chancellor of University of Juba to increase tuition fees. Winnie Chirino has more for VOA from Juba.
Vice Chancellors from the universities of Juba, Bargazal, Upper Nile, Rumbek and Dr. John Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology were summoned by the Parliament's Education Committee to discuss why they plan to dramatically increase tuition fees. Professor John Akech, Vice Chancellor of the University of Juba, told the committee that public universities want to increase tuition fees to meet the university's operational costs. In 2015, he said medical students paid 5,000 South Sudanese pounds, or about $1,300, an amount he says is too little today. Aked says the university is proposing to raise tuition to 35,000 South Sudanese pounds, or about $225 a year. He says if the government refuses to approve that increase, it should find an alternative source of funds to run the universities.
For us at Juba, it's clear that we will never be able to proceed with anything, you know, until we get a very clear agreement about, you know, how much we will actually if you are saying that is fair, you really have to come up with saying, okay, you know, reduce it by 25%, by 10%, by 50%. And then also, let us meet the president, let us talk to the Minister of Finance, whether they will actually pay the other 50% of the deficit.
2 weeks ago, University of Juba students went on strike to protest a decision by the administration to increase tuition fees by more than 100%. Akech says the university must pay part-time staff, overtime allowances, fuel, and other assorted costs. He says current tuition fees will not cover the costs of running the institution because market prices have increased daily.
The cost of operation and maintenance and provision of essential services has actually been rising since January 2016. At the same time, the tuition fee have not coped with inflation and the cost of operation. For example, in 2014 and 2015 roughly, the average weekly operation cost was 150,000 a week. But today, and the average weekly cost now averages about 5 million.
Professor Abraham Mato, Vice Chancellor of Dr. John Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology, says the government provides universities with some money to meet operational costs, but it's nearly enough even after tuition fees are paid.
Only to open a semester, first semester, it is an amount of 10,342,000 only for a semester. I cannot make it now. There was a promise that the operation cost is actually increased to 2.5 for Dr. John Garang. The last one we received while I am there, only 1.5, the old one.
Ahmed Mohamed, who chairs the National Assembly's Committee on Education, says lawmakers will work with the heads of public universities to find a solution and will meet with Higher Education Minister Deng Deng Hoch to discuss the matter. Mohamed says in the meantime, the heads of universities have agreed to reopen their institutions as they try to find an amicable solution.
Actually, the university are now on process of opening. Even the University of Juba, some days ago, I went there by myself. I've seen that the students are collecting the forms of registration. Even Dr. John Garang, as he said in the meeting, that they are going to open. They are all agreed that they will open, but they will get it very hard to continue for a month or more because of the money.
Mohammed says he will schedule additional meetings with the vice chancellors to work out a compromise. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, hundreds of South Sudanese are able to see again. Find out why when we come back after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
do you think healthcare should be free?
Yes, I think so, because if it is free, everybody will go to the hospital when he or she is sick. But because of money, some people will be sick and they'll still be in the house.
People will have to go to hospital, but because of unemployment, they can't pay for the hospital bills. So I think it must be free.
I do not think healthcare should entirely be free, no. But certain levels of healthcare, like the basic level of checkups, doing checkups, that can be free. The rest can be taken care of by the individual.
I think healthcare should be free because that is one of the social responsibilities of governments.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America, and it's time for our Tuesday health segment. Today we are talking about eye surgeries. A U.S.-based nonprofit called Partners in Compassion Care has hired a South Sudanese doctor to perform eye surgeries on more than 180 patients in Jonglei State Capital Bor this past week. As Guy Deng reports from Bor, the doctors plan to operate on more than other 100 patients in the area.
60-year-old Mary Ayang Thiek says she lost her vision about 3 years ago. Speaking in her native Dinka language, Ayak says after her doctor removed cataracts from her eyes, her vision returned.
Before the operation, everything was dark and I could not see. But now it is better. I can see my food. I can go to the bathroom by myself, so there is nothing much I can say, but I thank the doctor who has helped me see again.
That doctor, South Sudanese Santino Malang, was hired by Partners in Compassionate Care to perform the operations.
We are going on well. We have started from 18 at the ICAM. We have screened over 600 patients, and we have booked many of them. Up to now, we have done 172 cataracts as we speak. Up to the end of the day, we'll be finishing with 181. Yeah, I feel good. If somebody was not able to see, and after the operation, they see again, so I also feel happy. Not only the patient, myself, but I also happy to see that somebody is able to walk again alone by himself.
Speaking in Dinka, 50-year-old patient Manyatem says he too can see again after successful surgery.
If God has brought the doctor to come and help us like he is doing now, then all someone like me can say is appreciation. I was in a difficult condition, depending on someone else for everything.
Atem, Ayak and other patients say they are learning quickly to be self-reliant again after undergoing the surgery. Unfortunately, says Dr. Malang, not all patients are able to have their sight restored.
People with glaucoma, people with corneal scar, that we are not able to restore their sight. So what happened, we just tell them we are not able to do it, and we just cancel them. So it's sad for them, and also we feel that it's bad. Okay. The patient does not feel good, but there's nothing we can do.
Deng Ajang Jongkuch, Executive Director for Partners in Compassionate Care, says the eye operation began about a week ago and will continue until April 2nd. He says there was a real need for this kind of surgery in Bor.
The reason we take this program because of vulnerability of the elderly people, These are fragile age group. They don't have money to go to Juba, to go to Kenya, and go to Uganda. And cataract is a simple thing. It's a 15-minute surgery, but it can destroy somebody's life. Most of these people are not productive. They are assigned to somebody who take care of them, from showers to the bathroom to bed to food. But when they are operated, they become independent and do things that they can do by themselves. And that's very rewarding.
John Kuch says each surgery costs about $100, cheaper than just about anywhere in the world for the same operation. He says the non-profit will spend about $50,000 to perform the operations in Bor, but will take the cataract surgery to other areas of Jonglei if his group receives more donations.
The need for cataract surgery is huge. It's big. It's big. It's huge. We will never finish. We will never finish everybody. I wish we can have eye center in Bor here. We have cataract surgeon here. Abraham Tong is in Bor here. And he's not doing surgeries because there's no support. So anybody who wants to help us is highly welcome. We are willing to partner and to have a permanent eye clinic here in Bor. And we can have a mobile clinic. We can go to Pibor, we can go to Ayod, we can go to Akobo, we can go to Twig East, and even the other side of the Nile.
Partners in Compassionate Care conducted an ICAM clinic and successfully operated on more than 150 patients suffering from cataracts or trachoma. Ajak says he has gone back to the U.S. to solicit more funds from donors, especially from South Sudanese American community. The nonprofit was formed in 2004 in the Midwestern state of Michigan by American David Bowman for the purpose of providing humanitarian health care to South Sudanese. For VOA News, I am Deng Gaiding, reporting from Bor.
We now turn to Kenya, where the government and well-wishers in Nairobi have sent foodstuff to Turkana and West Pokot districts to help thousands of Kenyans who have been starving due to drought. Local leaders in Turkana and Pokot have reported deaths from the drought, but the government denies the reports. Rahel Ombur has this report for VOA from Nairobi.
In early March, while riding his motorbike in Kenya's Turkana region, Eric Eyan came across an old man with jerrycans lying by the side of the road. When he stopped to help, he found the man was dead. Eyan says the man must have been looking for water. Eyan says he believes many more have died due to the drought in northwest Kenya. There is hunger and a lot of suffering on the ground. There are those saying there is no hunger. They should come to the area and see how people are suffering, how livestock is dying, how people have problems with accessing water. Residents say the drought began 2 months ago, which is not uncommon in the arid region. Arid and semi-arid lands of Kenya make up almost 80% of the country. Last week, Kenya Cabinet Secretary Eugene Wamalwa acknowledged the dire situation.
And we are here to just let the country know that we need the drought situation. The northern part of the country is worsening with time. Our experts have been able to show us that indeed the short rains did not do very well in the 2018 short rain season, and that the long rains have equally delayed.
The government set aside nearly $40 million last year to counter the effects of a drought that was declared a national disaster. Wamalwa says the government is working with the local leaders to relieve the current situation.
We want to thank Governor Nanok, the county government of Turkana, which has been greatly affected, for moving fast and putting in place the necessary remedial measures to help his people in Turkana. But as of last week, he did reach out to us that he has more or less exhausted what they have set aside as the county government, and they have now requested us as national government to step in.
The government says It is distributing food to about 2,000 affected people, but the situation is triggering public anger and a demand for long-lasting solutions. Many Kenyans on social media say they will not fundraise for drought relief efforts every year, and government leaders should be held accountable. Ayan says a permanent solution is needed. The government should consider permanent solution in the area, perhaps digging wells or reservoirs and other long-term solutions that can help the situation. Aid agencies continue to distribute food, but locals like Ayan say if a solution is not provided next year, Turkana and other drought-prone areas will be in the news again. Raya Lombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Zimbabwe's government said today that the number of deaths related to rains in the country has increased to 180. The number could go higher as authorities are still trying to determine how many are missing following last week's rains. Columbus Mavunga reports from Chimanimani, about 500 kilometers southeast of Harare.
Addressing visiting United Nations officials in the most affected area in Zimbabwe, Lloyd Kasima, the acting district administrator for Chimanimani, said Cyclone Idai deaths now stand at 181. He said authorities are trying to figure out how many people are missing.
Traditionally, we used just to experience some minor excessive rainfalls, and we could just manage that and control. But this disaster was too much for us, was too big. The rivers flooded, creating new rivers, new streams. In the process, a lot of people were swept away in their homes. Some died, and some up to now are not known where they are.
Kasima said the situation has been made worse by power outages, which has hampered communication and flooding that cut off streets and highways. The British-based charity organization Save the Children is trying to determine how many of the missing are children. Here is Sophie Amantishe, the organization's spokeswoman in Zimbabwe.
Right now, as we talk, the actual numbers of children who have been affected is not known because the statistics are difficult to come by. We don't even know how many children are missing in total because you have statistics coming from different areas and some are conflicting. The major challenge that we are having is accessing the people who need the much-needed aid that we want to deliver. The areas are inaccessible.
She said, once all roads become accessible, statistics would be available of who was actually affected. The Zimbabwean government Tuesday said more than 40,000 people had been left food insecure by Cyclone Idai, while more than 7,000 had their homes destroyed. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Chimanimani, Zimbabwe.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Sudan by Lomerica.
Sudan, oh.
We have been listening to Lomerica Jazz Band with the song Sudan. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. If you would like to share with us comments on this show, you can find us on southsudan@voanews.com. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Sudani, Belet Gebi, the Africa.